Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Today we're welcoming back Dr. Kurt Thompson, and we'll be continuing our discussion on his book, Anatomy of the Soul. Kurt, welcome back to Heartline.
Thanks, Rita. It's great to be back.
We've been talking about the idea of how it's possible to rewire your mind, altering brain patterns, and literally making you more like the person God created you to be. We spent a good portion of last week talking about this idea of being known. And as people helpers, we spend a significant portion of our time helping people make sense of their own narratives, which include a firmly entrenched set of core beliefs about self, God, and the world around them. For a lot of people, this did not include learning to check the emotional pulse on their hearts. Yet you argue strongly that without the process of being known, we can't really know ourselves, God, or others. It'll be harder to connect. So can you give us some practical tools that we can teach people to assist them in this process of being known?
Sure. One of the things that we talk about in Anatomy of the Soul are these different functions of the mind. And what I suggest as the first function, not necessarily the most important, but it is kind of the point of the spear, as it were, is the function of attention. One of the most important questions that we put to folks is, how well are you paying attention to what you're paying attention to? And the reason that that's significant is because in the function of the mind, our attentional mechanism is the lead dog in everything. Everything we do because of some shift in attention. Whether it's intentional and conscious or automatic and involuntary, it is the attention of our mind that is leading everything else. And so where the attention goes, everything else tends to follow. Our problem often, however, is that we're not really even paying attention to what we're paying attention to. So to answer your question, one of the first tools that we suggest are important for folks is actually the strengthening of the attentional muscle. It is the process in which we can begin to literally become aware that, A, our attention is something that is moving all the time, that we do have control over, and also that we do often kind of turn loose on its own without our, you know, paying much attention to where it's going. And so one of the first simple tools that we give to folks is what I call a sift exercise, to sift your mind. Now, we don't talk about this particularly in the book, but the sift exercise stands for S-I-F-T, or sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts. And the fact is that much of our mental activity can be described using those four words. And a very simple exercise that people can do is to, once an hour, take 30 seconds and stop and inquire what have been the sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts that have been going through my mind during the last hour. And you don't have to spend more than 60 seconds doing that. But every time we do that, we practice paying attention to those sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts, and so forth. That's a simple example of that kind of what it means to exercise our attentional mechanism. There are other exercises, such as breathing exercises, that one can do. Something as simple as, we say there's a 6 breaths per minute exercise that we can do to give us an awareness of our attention, and then to more explicitly help us see that our attention is often, this is the next step that's important, our attention is often someplace other than where we are. Most of us spend a lot of time, in terms of where our attention goes, living somewhere in the future or somewhere in the past, in terms of what we imagine, what we sense, what we image, and so forth, as opposed to being right where we are. So the more we are exercising attention, the more we are then able to be closer to the present moment. And I hope I'm being clear with that, because I'm spending less time worrying about the future or regretting the past. And in so doing, if we are focusing our attention then on other things that the biblical narrative, for instance, teaches us, such as, you are my daughter whom I love, you are my son whom I love, attending to that, not just as a fact, not just as a verse that we memorize, but as a felt experience, imagining being in Jesus' presence, imagining hearing that, imagining feeling the touch of the Father, practicing this over and over again, gives us our initial sense of what it means to begin to change the wiring in our brain.
Also, I use the spiritual disciplines in my teaching my clients, and I know that in the book you mentioned that. So the spiritual disciplines, not as another checklist that we have to cross off, but a place where people can actually slow it down and connect with the heart of God through contemplative prayer, meditation, silence and solitude. I think we're all running at such a fast pace today that, like you say, we aren't paying attention to much of anything except for just trying to get by and get everything done in a day. And I notice, working with a lot of people with anxiety, they're not noticing even the physical cues in their bodies.
That's right.
So part of it is helping them, I call it the art of noticing, just getting people to pay attention physiologically to what's going on in their bodies and teaching them those things, as well as, you know, getting into the spiritual piece, maybe having them meditate on one verse for a week.
Right.
You know,
right.
Practicing those disciplines that you talk about in the book too.
Right. I think, you know, you raise a really important question. You know, one of the things that we talk about in the opening chapters of Anatomy of the Soul is that the mind is both embodied and relational. The mind is not simply reducible to the brain, nor is the mind, as far as the body is concerned, just within the structure of the central nervous system. It is literally embodied. So, for instance, when we say that we feel anxious, many people notice, the first thing that they notice when they're anxious are sweaty palms, or they notice a distress in their solar plexus or in their stomach, or their jaw is tight. That certainly is not in the brain. That is a physiologically experienced and expressed form of mind activity. And if our minds are going to be transformed and renewed, that means that by extension, so are our bodies going to be transformed as well. Spiritual disciplines, the beauty of spiritual disciplines is that they enable us to come in contact reflectively with every dimension of who we are. Not just what we think, but what we imagine, what we sense physiologically. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if once you start to fast, you begin to recognize how many of our regulation processes are taken care of by simply impulsively eating. And we begin to notice how much of my mind is being shaped by these behaviors of going to the refrigerator, for example. And I don't even have to, I mean, it can just be, you know, going to get, you know, one or two cookies. It's not that I have to eat a whole sleeve of Girl Scout cookies. But the fact that these spiritual disciplines really bring to the forefront and bring to our awareness an entire range of different ways in which God is trying to renew our whole self, not just some abstract thing that we think about, you know, what is true theologically. So you're absolutely right about that. I think the other thing that is significant about this is that when we practice spiritual disciplines in community, we exponentially enhance their power. Because in the same way that I tell my story to another as a way to be known, when I am fasting together with someone else, it is a process in which what is coming up in me through that fasting process will also be something that I can share with another and be known by them, and vice versa. And the entire process itself does really, we've watched, like, does really unleash the Holy Spirit to do things that are quite different than when I'm just doing this by myself. And as such, really kind of sheds light on Jesus' comment that when two or more are gathered, the Spirit will be there and will be active in ways that are different and unique from when a person is by themselves.
Help people understand, you know, we're throwing around this rewire the brain thing a lot, rewiring these neural pathways. Help people understand on a practical level what that means for them to have these neural pathways rewired. Like, does this mean, oh, my old beliefs will automatically disappear? Does this mean I won't be anxious or depressed, or my problems with my husband are going to get better? What does that really mean for the average person?
That's a great question. It's probably reasonable to bring in just a little bit of history of neurology. A gentleman by the name of Donald Hebb, a Canadian neuropsychologist back in the 1940s, did some experiments in which it became clear that if you had a series of neurons that all represented a certain function or pattern of behavior. So let's say, for instance, I grow up in a house where every time someone raises their voice, the next thing that happens is that somebody gets hit. So you can imagine that those neurons that represent that firing pattern of the voice, I hear a loud voice, and then someone gets hit, and consequently I'm going to be really hypersensitive to anyone raising their voice. In the brain, the more often this happens, the easier it is for those neurons to fire together. And as we like to say, the Hebb's axiom is those neurons that fire together wire together. And so it's like, you know, if I wanted to memorize that 3 times 4 is 12, the way that I do that is that I repeat it over and over and over again. And mm-hmm. as I do so, the neural networks in my brain that represent that function of 3 times 4 is 12 continue to fire in such a way that after a while it just becomes automatic, and it's fairly permanent in my brain. It doesn't really ever go away. I mean, if you've ever learned that 3 times 4 is 12, you know, you can't really, like, forget it. It's hard to forget.
Right.
In the same way, if I grew up in a family where every time someone raises their voice, someone gets hit, it will be hard to forget that. And so when I then go into a marriage where if someone raises their voice, even just because they're excited about something, and I withdraw and I, you know, kind of step back from that relationship and don't want to have interaction with them, that is my mind literally remembering that, and it's hard to forget.
Mm-hmm.
That wiring never goes away. And we might look at that and say, oh my gosh, that's really not very pleasant news, Kurt, because, like, it'll always be with me. And we say, yeah, you're right. But the good news is that that does not have to be the only response that you are left with. 25 years ago, when I was in medical school, it was believed that, for the most part, if you had damaged neurons because of a stroke, there was very little you could do about it in terms of repair. We now have very different evidence that suggests that the brain is far more malleable and far more able to generate new neurons and new neuron pathways than we ever believed was true 25 years ago. Consequently, what we know is that there are certain things that we can do to enhance what we call neuroplasticity, or the brain's capacity for plastic or malleable change. And some of those things include increased aerobic exercise, creative activity and novelty, creative activities such as learning a new foreign language, artwork, learning to play a new instrument, those kind of creative actions that require the stretching of neural networks, or what we call meaningful novelty, trying things out that are new and different, that stretch us, but not just in repeated ways. So, for instance, you could do a crossword puzzle, which is a great thing to do, but learning music is different because you're constantly having to stretch and do something new beyond what you've just learned. So there are that, among other things, that one can do to enhance neuroplasticity, or the capacity for a person to change. But a couple of other things that are crucially important: one is a good diet, two is plenty of rest, not a lot of which we get in our culture, and the third, interestingly enough, is deeply connected community. And it is in this community that we can be invited to begin to, as we said earlier, we can tell our story, and it is in the process of being listened to, being known by another, that new neural networks in our brain can be turned on.
Wow.
And as those networks are turned on, and then I might add, practice, as they are practiced, we tell that story again and again and again. And as we then engage in spiritual disciplines, which help us to write and help us to think and reflect and to engage in this new story again and again, we are actually practicing Hebb's axiom. We are laying down new neural networks and practicing them in such a way that though the old networks do not ever die off, the new networks do step forward and tend to take front and center stage. So when St. Paul writes about in Romans chapter 7, why do I keep doing the things that I say that I don't want to do? We would say that from a neuroscience standpoint, this gives us a bit of an answer. The answer is that those old neural networks are dying. As we like to say, crucifixion is an apt form of death because it takes such a long time to die. The death of these old neural networks in our mind, the networks that represent my irritability, my impatience, my impulsivity, and so all these things, my greed, my gluttony, I mean, and the list goes on for me. All those neural networks that represent that are dying in Jesus' crucifixion. And these new neural networks that are being raised represent the hope of what is coming in the new heaven and new earth. But as Paul says, we have the Holy Spirit as a way right now to activate that and make that a reality even now through the communities that we build by being known and activating these new networks in a practiced way.
And what I'm hearing you say is, and what I hammer into my clients is, you have to be intentional and deliberate about it. You have to practice this stuff.
That's absolutely right. I mean, what we often don't recognize, again, back to like, are we paying attention to what we're paying attention to? What we often don't recognize is, you know, when a toddler is learning to walk, if you were to just film that toddler during the times, at the time that they're beginning to learn to walk, you'll find that about 80 to 90% of their intentional conscious energy is going into them learning to walk. They are focusing their attention on how to stand and wobble, how to, like, you know, cruise along the couch, mm-hmm. how to then step away from that. You can tell, like, a lot of conscious, intentional energy is going into that. Practice, 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 practice. We just think that we just get up and walk, but the reason we get up and walk is because we remember how to do it. And we can remember how to do it because we spent a lot of conscious, intentional energy practicing that. When I learned how to cope with my father's alcoholism or my mother's depression or my brother's sexual abuse or whatever it was, whatever we do to cope with these things, we practice these coping strategies over and over again, though we're not necessarily aware that that's what we're doing.
Absolutely, yeah.
What we're saying is that the gospel invites us to practice a new reality of the mind.
I don't know about you, but where many of my clients get stuck is on their feelings with this. I mean, they feel, I do a lot of eating disorder work, and they feel fat. I feel fat. So I believe I am fat, you know, and this is, I mean, again, you know, they're emaciated and they feel fat. You say emotions go much deeper than just feelings. So what do people need to know about emotions that are going to help them move forward? Because so often, I mean, I know in my own life, all of us, we just get so hung up on, well, I don't feel God's presence, or, oh, this doesn't work, I've tried it, or on and on and on.
Yes. Well, you know, earlier we talked about this exercise. We call this SIFT exercise. One of the roles that that exercise can play is that it helps us to see that we are not reducible to sensations, images, feelings, or thoughts. And it is significant. I mean, you are correct that it's very difficult for us as human beings to separate what we feel from our sense of what really is. I mean, if a person who is having a visual hallucination sees the dog under the table, but there is no dog, it's going to be pretty tough to convince them that there's no dog. They sense that. And we live by our senses. We live very powerfully by our senses all the time. And so when I feel fat, when I feel shame, when I feel a range of different things, it's very difficult for me to somehow just step outside of that. Now, this is why we would say that the interaction with community is so hugely important, because to have my own thinking process, say, like, I feel fat, confronted by someone else who says, well, tell me more about that, or someone who says, gosh, you don't appear to be that way, tell me more about that, and ask me the kinds of questions that can enable me to step out and see that as just a feeling, that is what's going to be most crucially important, to have community that can help us separate that. So when we say, I don't feel God's love, it makes a difference then when they are with someone else who is engaging them in a loving way, because this then puts this in an embodied place in which I can feel the love of my counselor, I can feel the love of my friend or my pastor, my spiritual director, and I need to be able to pay attention to that. But it is also important to know that for some people, no matter how much effort we as a helping group offer, there are some people for whom the terror of giving up what they feel, because those feelings also act as coping strategies in and of themselves, the terror of giving up what they feel is greater than the feeling itself. And so, not unlike the rich young ruler, right, we would say, gosh, you know, if we were to have a psychological evaluation done of him, or we were to sit down and ask him, like, what does this feel like to have, he would probably say, like, I don't like what I'm feeling when I have to, you know, the feeling of giving up my wealth, what I imagine that will be like, feels like it's too much.
Because they attach a meaning to it, just like the eating disorder folks. They attach a meaning to what it feels like to not, or to be fat, or to not have an eating disorder.
Right, they do attach a meaning to it, but the other thing that we do, because this is the other thing we in our groups, we talk an awful lot about this, that the brain is a very, very powerful anticipation machine. And it is constantly anticipating the future, whether the future is 5 seconds from now or 5 years from now. The brain is constantly evaluating its past, evaluating what's in its networks from what we would call is our past, as a way to anticipate the future. And if my anticipation of the future is too terrifying, given your invitation to me to stop binging, it will be very difficult for me to stop binging, because what you're asking me to do is to anticipate a future that it is almost virtually impossible for me to do, because I don't have any remembered template of it in my brain.
Mm.
And so it does require risk. So, for instance, the person who's had some kind of trauma, we use the example all the time of, you know, somebody who has a near-drowning experience as a 4-year-old in a pool, never goes back to the pool because all they remember is the drowning experience, the near-drowning experience. And so if then, as an adult, they're going to try to get back in the pool, they're not going to just go jump in the pool. They're going to have to take it very easy because it's difficult for them to imagine anything having to do with the pool that does not end catastrophically.
Right.
They don't have any memory, and it doesn't matter that they are well aware that there are other people who get in the pool and don't drown. In their brain, the pool is represented by panic. And so with them, we ask them to simply widen their window of tolerance very gradually. This is very difficult to do. So this is why we, you know, with eating disorder patients and with some others, it's very challenging because even to get them to do the slightest of movement can be very difficult based on their anticipated future. Again, why it is that ongoing community is so crucially important. But again, when you mention eating disorders, it's a primary example of how we can't guarantee good outcomes. We can't guarantee that for folks because they ultimately have the choice about what they're going to do.
Absolutely, they do. They have to choose. Kurt, I could talk to you all day about this. Unfortunately, we're out of time again. How can folks get a hold of you? How can they get the book? They can get the book on my website at siftedaswheat.com through the Amazon widget, but give us your website and information.
Yes, you can go to www.beingknown, that's BEINGKNOWN.com. And I do a lot of speaking around the area and actually in different parts of the country on this topic. And if anyone's interested in my coming to do a workshop or speaking engagement on our website, there is a place where you can invite me to speak. Would be happy to do that. And if you want to contact me, there's a way for you to do that too. It's on the website. It's pretty clear.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to be with us and share.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure, Rita.
All right. God bless. Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.